And I said to him, we've got the whole team around the table. Before we jump into the agenda, maybe we could spend a minute or two and you could just thank them in person for all the great work they've done. I mean, we've only been working together a couple months and you've been in like blue chip media, print, online, television. You've gotten some really good quotes, really good press. And he looked at me and he said, thank you. Why would I thank you? I'm paying you. And I was like, oh my God. And I said, well, it's funny you should say that. We actually, you haven't paid us the last 2 months. And I'm hoping that at the end of this meeting, you could go back to your desk, grab your checkbook, and we could walk out of here and get caught up.
Welcome to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for micropreneurs building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. I'm your host, Candace Ridardi, and today I'm joined by marketing maven Paige Arnoff-Fenn. Paige is the CEO of Mavens and Moguls, a global marketing and digital branding agency in Cambridge, Massachusetts. With clients such as Microsoft, Virgin, and the New York Times, she is a branding expert. Paige holds degrees from Stanford University and Harvard Business School. She's a prolific speaker and columnist, contributing to Entrepreneur and Forbes. Her wisdom on personal branding in the digital world emphasizes authenticity and strategic choice of online platforms. For many professionals, Paige underscores the importance of an active LinkedIn presence for credibility and building trusted relationships. Welcome, Paige!
Thanks, Candace, for having me. I'm so excited to chat today.
I can't wait to have this conversation because your business, Mavens and Moguls, has one of my most favorite words, and it's one of the most important things that anybody should learn how to be, and that is a maven. So before we get into that, let's talk about you. Tell us how you got to where you are today.
So it's been a long, circuitous route. If you and I had met when I was in school, I would have never guessed I'd be doing what I'm doing. I think Steve Jobs was right that careers only make sense looking backwards, not forwards. Because, you know, I grew up in a family where my father and both grandfathers were commercial bankers. So I always thought I'd go work for a bank because I was good with numbers and I was a lot like my dad and grandpa's. And I did a summer internship at Wells Fargo Bank in San Francisco in college. And I really liked it, but I just didn't feel like it kind of spoke to me. They made me an offer to come back after graduation, but I just thought I was cut out to do something different. And I decided I graduated from college in the 80s. And Michael Douglas had just won the Oscar for the Wall Street movie. If you are old enough to remember Greed is Good, I got kind of hooked on that whole like image. And I ended up going to work in New York City for an investment bank. So I thought I was doing something related, but even cooler than my dad and grandpa's by going into investment banking. And I realized very quickly that it was not going to be a long-term relationship for me, but I had made a 2-year commitment to the bank. So I stuck it out. I did as great of a job as I could possibly do. And then I went back to business school and rebranded myself to be a marketing person. And I've been in marketing ever since. My first chapter in marketing was in big corporate jobs, Procter & Gamble, Coca-Cola, consumer products marketing. Then in the 90s, I got bitten by the dot-com bug, and I left my big corporate cushy marketing job to go work for a startup in Los Angeles, and that company went public and was sold to Yahoo. And then I did 2 more startups as the head of marketing, and those companies had good exits as well. And then right after 9/11, when all the marketing jobs kind of dried up, I hung out a shingle and started my own firm, thinking I'd do it for just a short bit. And now it's been 22 years and I'm still at it. So, you know, I joke, I'm like the accidental entrepreneur. I never thought I would start a marketing company. I thought I'd be Meg Whitman running a big Fortune 500 company, but I love what I do. And I can't imagine having done anything else. All those jobs I told you about, my longest stint was 3.5 years. And now I've worked for myself for 22 years. So if I get sick of my boss this time, I'm dead.
I have so many things I want to talk about. Okay. First of all, Greed is Good. If I remember that movie correctly, It turns out greed wasn't really all that good.
Yep, your memory is spot on. But I was just so enamored by like all these Wall Street traders, and they looked like they were just playing. They didn't even look like they were working. They were having fun, screaming and yelling and cursing. And it just, you know, when you're a college kid, and they got paid ridiculous amounts of money. And I think when you're in school and you don't have a lot of money, you know, something that looks fun, that pays you well, I just thought, wow, that looks amazing. And they seemed, you know, they seemed like people I would enjoy working with and hanging out with. And they were good with numbers. I was good with numbers. It seemed to be a career path that would play to my strengths. But in fact, your memory is quite sharp. If you have any recollection of that era, Liar's Poker was a book that was very popular then, written about the Wall Street culture. You know, it was kind of a sick environment. People worked 800 hour weeks. You know, they had to, because they made a lot of money, they spent a lot of money to try and make up for the fact that they worked so hard. And a lot of people just didn't have relationships with their family or their friends. They were living at work. And, you know, it took a toll. They would buy expensive toys, cars, boats, vacations, to make up for the fact that they weren't very happy. And I looked at my boss and my boss's boss and my boss's boss's boss, and I didn't want any of their careers or lives. So when I left to go back to business school, I made a pact with myself that I would find a different path. It might not pay as well, but I was going to do something that spoke to me and kind of made my heart happy and would let me be more creative and balance kind of my left and right brain. I didn't want just a pure, intense, quantitative job or life.
Yeah. And I think that there's a definition of happiness that is that you can live the life that you want to live, that is the absolute ultimate definition of happiness. And a lot of folks think that happiness comes from having a lot of money, when I think that happiness comes from being able to take the day off on a Wednesday, right? I base my happiness based on how well I've organized my schedule so that I can have as much free time as possible, right? Can I actually get all the work I need to get done in less than 10 hours a week? You know, which is a completely different way of thinking about. I mean, I was probably 15 or 16 years old when that movie came out. And so, you know, aside from everybody swooning over Charlie Sheen, you know, my age bracket, you know, I had a different perspective of it of the movie. And after that, I was like, well, what, you know, I want to have a good, decent life. But my life doesn't look the way I thought it would when I was 15, right? No, at all.
Nobody's does.
So what's your advice for somebody who's 15 years old right now, who thinks that they're going to follow a career path?
I mean, I think your job when you're a teenager, when you're, you know, at that point in your life, is to figure out the stuff that you enjoy doing. What are your strengths? What's intuitive to you? What do you have fun doing? And figure out, are there people you can talk to, adults maybe, that seem to be have strengths in those areas, that seem to be doing careers in those areas that are appealing to you in a genuine, authentic way? Not because they're paid a lot of money, but because they really seem to like bounce out of bed and love doing what they're doing, and they love talking about doing what they're doing, and they have great stories to tell you. And it doesn't seem like drudgery or a drag. They don't seem exhausted every time you happen to run into them, if they're friends of your parents or a neighbor or an aunt or an uncle. You know, I think you can get a sense that people like are genuinely jazzed. They love telling you like, oh my God, the coolest thing happened this week at work. Or I just learned the most interesting thing when I was on this project. And you could, I think kids sense that. You don't have to be an adult that's, you know, launched into the world. You really feel it in your gut. Like, these people seem happy and they seem like normal, like, and they get to play tennis on the weekends and they take vacations to the beach every summer. Like, it's a normal, existence where they can hang out with people that matter to them, and they get to work on things that they're solving problems that matter to them, or they work on things that genuinely interest them. It's not that like, oh, did you see my new Ferrari? Or did I tell you about this heli-skiing vacation I took, you know, in Europe? And let me brag about, you know, how many frequent flyer miles I have, or all the expensive things I bought when I was on vacation.
Yeah.
That doesn't resonate.
Or I took my family on vacation, but in the middle of the vacation, I left them and went back to work and then came back at the end of the vacation.
Bingo. And you hear stories like that, and an alarm bell should be going off, like, run. Do not go into that room. Go elsewhere. Turn around and run as fast as you can in the other direction.
So when I was in my early 20s, I had a really fun job, the kind of job that I didn't think I'd ever have. like if you told me when I was 15 that I'd have this job when I was 23, I never would have believed you, right? But it was a lot of fun. And one day I pulled into the parking lot, and right next to me, getting out of his car, was the CEO of the company. And he was driving a new car. And it wasn't a new car, but it was a gently used new car to him. And I said, hey, you got a new car? And he goes, new to me. And here he is, the CEO of this very well-known, really cool company that a lot of people knew about. And he was driving he just bought a new to him used vehicle, right? And I was just like, that's the kind of guy that I could follow loyally, right? I could loyally follow him. And something else that he did was that whenever the company sponsored events and they had t-shirts made, he ordered 200 extra t-shirts so that everybody who worked at the corporate office got a t-shirt. And he would personally walk around and hand a t-shirt to every single employee. And I'm like, you know, that there, and you know what he does now? He does startups now. But the reason why I was telling that story is because you've worked with startups, you've worked in big corporations. What are some leadership lessons that you have learned? That was mine.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect example of someone that has great values that resonate with your values. And they clearly attracted people who cared about those same things. And when you work with people who kind of clean up well, they do well by doing good, you feel that. You feel great about going to work every day. You know, I have the counter example of that. The first startup I worked for, it was like Internet 1.0. And when we went public, the two founders were younger than me. You know, this was a classic Internet 1.0 story. And the week we went public, one of the founders drives up to work in an $80,000 car. And I saw him in the parking lot and I was like, wow, new car. And he's like, yeah, we just went public. I'm rich. And I'm like, you do realize that, like, we're insiders. We can't sell the stock for 6 months. You're rich on paper. You're not rich in real life yet.
Yeah.
Like, and that's kind of made my stomach turn, because those aren't my values. That is not the way that I live my life, or I would want my friends and family or my team to live their life. And so I think the lessons of the leaders that I worked for, the one thing I can say, when you have bad bosses, unfortunately, you learn a lot more from the bad ones than you do from the good ones. I think the negative examples, like, I've got the war wounds to prove it. Like, I, you know, you say to yourself, I don't want to be like that when I grow up. I think I had Wall Street bosses, like you said, that kind of had their whole value system screwed up, in terms of they spent way more time developing relationships at work, some of which were inappropriate, than with their own families. And that was very well accepted in that culture, and something that I really didn't want to replicate. I didn't want to kind of continue that behavior. I think the best bosses in my career, at big companies, at startups, and with my clients, are people that really, they know what makes them tick, and they're authentically themselves. You know, they know what's important to them. One of my first clients, when I started my company, Mavens and Moguls, was a woman who had worked for very successful companies. And she had watched CEOs, when companies were sold or went public, walk around and tell everybody, congratulations, you helped make this happen. You know, and she made sure when she started, it was a private company when she took the CEO role. She made sure every employee from the, bottom of the pyramid all the way to her direct reports, she made sure everybody in the company got stock. And when they were bought by a large public company, everybody benefited. And she walked around and shook everyone's hand and told them, like, you're going to be able to pay off your student loans. You're going to be able to clear your credit card debt. Like, and that was really important to her as a leader, that everyone participated in the upside. And, you know, we loved working for that client because they lived their values every day and people were glad to come to work and they were happy in the job. The flip side of that is I had a client, one of my very first clients, who we were doing PR for, and we were very successful in getting him and his business a lot of great PR. And this guy was really a jerk. And the more press we got him, the bigger jerk he became, because he loved seeing his name in print. He loved getting quoted. He loved, the interviews and the quotes, and he was very slow to pay us. So we were in month three of a 12-month engagement. He was paying us $10,000 a month, a retainer, and he was 2 months behind on payment in month three of a 12-month contract. And we were just about to sit down and start our agenda for the meeting. And I said to him, we've got the whole team around the table. Before we jump into the agenda, maybe we could spend a minute or two and you could just thank them in person for all the great work they've done. I mean, we've only been working together a couple months and you've been in like blue chip media, print, online, television. You've gotten some really good quotes, really good press. And he looked at me and he said, thank you. Why would I thank you? I'm paying you. And I was like, oh my God. And I said, well, funny you should say that. You haven't paid us the last 2 months. And I'm hoping that at the end of this meeting, you could go back to your desk, grab your checkbook, and we could walk out of here and get caught up. And he's like, well, let's get into the agenda. So that just set the tone for like a not very happy status update. So we get through the agenda. We have an hour into the meeting. We're wrapping up. And I asked him, again, can you go grab your checkbook? Let's get caught up. He did come back with a check. I thanked him and I said, I don't know that we're the right firm for you. I think you're going to be better served with a different partner. So instead of invoicing you for next month, I think now that we're caught up, we should shake hands and part ways. You've gotten a lot of great press and I am happy to recommend other firms, but I don't think this is the right team for you. And he was really taken aback and he said, wait a minute, are you firing me as a client? And I said, maybe I am. I think I am. And I have to say, it was such an empowering situation because my team knew that I had their back, that I didn't want them to be treated like crap, that I talked about having a no jerks policy, both internally and externally. I didn't want team members who were a pain in the butt. And I didn't want to work for clients who were jerks either. And I put my money where my mouth was. This was a six-figure engagement. And I was willing to walk away because I didn't like working with this guy. I didn't like the way he treated my team. And we were over-servicing him. We were giving him more time than he was paying for. And he didn't even appreciate it. He wouldn't even thank us for the great results. And it's like feng shui, I guess, when you kind of clear the clutter, you make room for better. Mm-hmm. And we were able to replace that revenue very quickly within a few weeks with clients that were a much better fit, consistent values to ours. And it, like I said, it just sent the team, it was like wind at our back. It made everybody feel much better about us, about our clients, about our values. And I just think, especially when it's your business, and it's your, the buck stops with you, you have to put your money where your mouth is. So I think whether the leaders are your bosses, your client leaders, you have to have the strength and the wherewithal to know what's right for you, because I think it would have been such a mistake. I mean, it would have been Wall Street all over again. You get paid a lot of money, so you put up with a lot of crap. And I just, that was what I said I would never do again. And I'm glad I stuck to it.
Yeah. Success is, can I take my staff to a movie at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Wednesday? Let's all just go see a movie together. If you can do that, who cares about the money, right?
Right. I think my definition of success changed a lot. You know, when you're young, you think success is money. Success is, you know, fancy houses, fancy cars, fancy clothes. And I mean, the last 3.5 years, I think, you know, living through a global pandemic, I think it was a life lesson for a lot of people globally that, you know, having a lot of money didn't insulate you from getting COVID.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if you were so fortunate to be able to continue doing your work remotely so you could stay safe and your family was safe and, you know, you were able to create bubbles with people you really care about that care about you, that is success. I mean, in this world that's so complicated and crazy and climate change and global pandemics and, you know, wars on multiple continents.
Yeah.
If you're able to create an ecosystem where you get paid fairly for your talents and skills, and you're able to, like you said, do what you want, when you want, with who you want, that is success, without a doubt. Has nothing to do with your bank account.
No, has to do with your resilience and your, yeah. So before I forget, I want to talk about how the market shifted after 9/11. And how the market shifted after 2008, and how the market shifted after the pandemic, and that the people who are doing well, what are the things that the people who survived all three of those have in common?
Resiliency and tenacity are like incredible characteristics that you have to learn and learn and relearn. You know, we pivoted and we pivoted and we pivoted. When I think about what the world looked like when I first hung out the shingle 22 years ago, Facebook was for college kids to determine whether someone was attractive or not. It was like, is she hot? Is he hot? And it was a teenage thing. There was no social media for grownups. When you talked about doing PR, when I first started the company, it was about issuing a press release over a newswire.
Yeah.
That was PR. There was no content marketing. There was no thought leadership. There was no newsjacking. All the things that we think of now as PR.
Yeah, it's
all different. It didn't exist 22 years ago.
There was social media for grownups back in 2001, though. It was called Yahoo Groups.
You're right. Now you're really dating yourself, Candace.
Hey, man, I am a total acceptance of my age and my experience. My age has made me who I am.
No, I, like I said, I've got all the war wounds to prove it. But it's interesting. You know, when I started my career at Procter & Gamble, P&G is probably the most data-driven consumer products company in the world. Doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter what I think. It's all about what your customers think. And they asked, you know, quantitative, qualitative. We did surveys. We did focus groups. We were constantly doing market research at P&G. When I went to a startup, those three startups, you know, at P&G, market research could take 6, 9, 12 months. It was statistically significant. You talked to thousands of people and it took a lot of time. When you go to a startup, you have a much smaller budget. If you waited 6, 9, 12 months at a startup, the whole market has moved. Whatever you learned would be completely irrelevant. So at the startup, my team and I would come in the morning, we'd grab coffee and sit around the conference room table. We'd come up with some things we needed to know about our target audience. We'd literally get feet on the street at lunch hour, intercept anybody on the street that looked like they were our target audience, ask them some questions, give them stuff to react to, give them some swag for to thank them for their 10 minutes of talking to us. We'd come back to the conference room after lunch. We'd incorporate what we'd learned, we tallied up all the results, and we put things up on the website before we went home at night to see if we could get people to click on it. And so the next morning we were reading the results. That got clicked on, this got ignored, this got passed along, and then we did a rate the next day. So market research was quick and scrappy and completely timely and relevant. And, you know, I learned that market research is critical. It's important to talk to your customers, but how you do that has to be relevant to your audience and relevant to the time. Once the internet 1.0 kicked in, those businesses don't run like big Fortune 500 companies. And now with my own firm, my clients don't have huge budgets to do research. So we are much scrappier. But I think, again, what we learned during COVID was whatever assumptions you made about your business before the pandemic, everything changed during the pandemic. Where you worked, how you worked, what you wore to work, how you vacationed, like, you know, it didn't matter anymore. You know, if you had a big fancy office, people weren't going to offices. They weren't going out to lunch from offices. You know, they were wearing yoga pants with a nice shirt. Exactly.
Like, I'm still wearing yoga pants and a nice shirt.
And so basically, whereas I used to try and convince my clients to do market research and they'd say, oh, I already know what my audience needs.
No, they don't.
But now they really don't know, and they realize they don't know. Because
even back in the day when they were doing research, I remember sitting in after I left that really cool job, I got another job that wasn't as cool. And one of the things that I did was I sat in a room behind a glass wall, you know, the glass where you can't see through. It's like a mirror on one side. And so I sat on the other side of the wall while they were interviewing people about our stores. It was a chain of retail stores. And the impression of every single person they interviewed was that we were an expensive store. Whereas the CEO and the owner, he was like, but we price match. And I'm like, well, if the perception, looking back at it now, if the and even then, because of where I had come from one of those expensive brands and to this job, right? And the perception is if you are perceived as an expensive brand, then why not just double down on it? Because then you'll attract the people who are going to spend the $800 for a coat rather than the people who want to spend 80. Just embrace it. Why are you trying to price match, right? So some people, even back then when all that market research was a thing, I'm sure it still is, but they still didn't get what they were learning. But I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I mean, the focus groups, that was kind of bread and butter at Procter & Gamble. We constantly were talking to our customers behind the one-way glass with a moderator. So my second assignment at Procter & Gamble was on CoverGirl makeup. They used to own CoverGirl Cosmetics. And we had a group of teenage girls that we recruited to come to our office after school. And we talked to them for a couple hours about makeup and their habits. And so we put lots of makeup on the table. Lipstick, nail polish, mascara, and there were probably a dozen girls around the table. And we asked them a lot of questions, and we told them, while we're talking, you can play with the makeup. And we knew every piece of makeup that was on that table. We gave them pizza and Coke, and we just talked and, you know, let them play, and they could go up and test the lipstick and polish their nails. At the end, you know, the thing about focus groups, and you've been to them, so you know, there's almost always one person in the room that's got the loudest voice that kind of dominates the conversation. And then people don't want to rock the boat or go against that person. So it kind of affects the tone and tenor. So with teenage girls, it's that on steroids, because there's like a queen bee who's really popular and really pretty. And when she says, I like the one with sparkles, everybody likes the one with sparkles. Or if, you know, whatever, you know, I like the pastel shades, then everybody says, oh, me too. I like the pastel shades. So fast forward, the focus group is over. We send them home. Then we go into the conference room and we count all the things that are left on the table. We know everything that they took home with them. We didn't say you can take the makeup home, but the girls, they lifted the things they really liked.
Yeah.
Guess what? The sparkles and the pastels were on all over the table.
Wow.
Nobody took those. They took the kind of bright colors. They took the matte colors. So what they said and what they did was very different, but nobody wanted to rock the boat. Nobody wanted to be an outlier publicly, but privately, what did they slip into their jeans pocket or their backpack? The stuff that they really liked.
Yeah.
So we had a very good sense of what the new colors were going to be based on what they took, not what they said.
That's
and
brilliant.
So research, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out. If you ask the wrong questions, if you let those loud voices dominate, you're being led down the wrong path. But you have to be very creative and scrappy sometimes, very resourceful to get really insightful customer data to make sure that you've got your eye on the right ball.
So you brought it up, the person in the room who's the loudest, who has the most opinions. That's not the definition of a maven, but no. I want to talk about mavens. Everybody knows what a mogul is. So your company is Mavens and Moguls, and everybody knows what a mogul is. Everybody imagines the top hat and the eyeglass and the $1 billion and the Monopoly board game. But what's a maven?
So a maven it's a Yiddish word for an expert. And my great grandmother would say know-it-all. But I love the alliteration of mavens and moguls. Yeah, mogul is someone of rank, power, or distinction in a specified area. If you look it up in the dictionary, you know, and I, when I started the company, I jokingly referred to the women as the marketing mavens and the guys as the marketing moguls. So as we were just getting formed, I would send the group emails, hey, mavens and moguls, blah, blah, blah. Here's what I'm thinking. Here's what I'm going to do with the website. What do you think? Blah, blah, blah. And, but then as the website got built, I said, we need a name. We need a logo. We need a tagline. And again, I grew up with market research. So I put together like a really quick online survey, you know, Zoomerang, SurveyMonkey, just a free quick questionnaire. And I sent it out to about 100 people that were either potential clients, potential people that would refer us, or gatekeepers, you know. So it could be a CEO, it could be a marketing person, maybe a CFO who's going to have to write the check, maybe somebody in the media who might be writing about us. And I sent out a list of names, and a lot of the names were very serious. Integrated marketing solutions, strategic marketing advisors. And I did a concept test. So I had Company X is a strategic marketing consulting firm. Company X can help you with your advertising, marketing, website, PR, market research. Company X needs to have a memorable name. We do not want to be we want to be the not your father's Oldsmobile version of marketing consulting firms. Here is a list of names for Company X. Please tell me if there are any that you really like or really don't like. Give me your top five names. And I sent it out over the internet to that list of people. And what came back, which was really interesting, is those serious names, you know, they didn't break through at all. I threw mavens and moguls in just because that's what I was calling everybody. Well, mavens and moguls made it into virtually everybody's top five.
Wow.
They didn't really even know necessarily what a maven was. Although Malcolm Gladwell had just written the book, The Tipping Point, and he used the word mavens.
Mm-hmm.
And so people like knew that it was kind of a trendy word. But again, the nice alliteration. Anyway, there were three people on the list who, when they responded, said, whatever you do, do not use mavens and moguls. I hate that name. It's too cutesy. You're not going to be taken seriously. But here are the names that I like. One of those three people said, by the way, I don't like one name on your list. I like Company X. I think it's kind of edgy. I'm like, Company X was just a placeholder to fill in the blank.
I think
So
somebody followed you recently and said, I'm going to take that name.
no, seriously. So yeah, maybe Elon Musk had the last laugh, right? So basically, I negated that. So the third person that didn't like any of the names, I threw out. The other two did not like mavens and moguls. Well, one of those two, about a day and a half after the survey, after I sent out the survey, called me unprompted and said, "Hey, so how did it turn out with your naming thing?" And I said, "You know, it's interesting. I got I was loved all the feedback. People were really generous to vote and return it." And the guy said, "So is it too late to change my vote?" And I said, "No, not at all. I mean, you know, it's an informal survey. What do you have in mind?" He said, "So I told you I picked a few names as you requested. And then I said, whatever you do, don't pick that silly name, Mavens and Moguls." He goes, "The problem is, I don't even remember what I picked, and I can't get that stupid name out of my head. And you had said you want the name to be memorable and stand out and have a little personality. I'm kind of thinking that's a much better choice. I don't know why I didn't like it 2 days ago, but I love it now." And that was like the aha moment, because a lot of people picked it because it stood out and they liked it. And then this guy just basically couldn't even remember the names that he liked 2 days before. So that was for me like the ultimate, you know, win on market research. Like, wow, we got to the right answer. And the amazing thing is, 22 years later, I still love the name and people do remember us. And, you know, people, they refer business to us, a lot of word of mouth. I was at a festival, like a fall festival, out, you know, the farmers market places that do like corn and tomato festival or strawberry festival. And I was with two girlfriends and we were walking from one station to the next. And one of my friends said, "Do you hear that?" And I said, "What?" And she said, "There's someone screaming, 'Hey, Maven. I think she's trying to get your attention.'" And I turn and there's this woman like, you know, "Maven, hey, Maven." And I was like, "Oh my God, I know her. She's a venture capitalist." So we walk over. She's like, "Oh my God, Paige, I am so glad to see you. I saw you across the way and I realized one of my portfolio companies has a major marketing problem and I need your help. And I saw you and I thought, oh my God, I've got to call Paige to get help for my company." And she said, "I could not remember. So I have a hyphenated last name. And my company has an ampersand between mavens and moguls." She said, "It's so crazy because yesterday I could not remember your last name. I could not remember the full name of your company. All I did was Google Page and Mavens and it popped right up." She said, "You are number one on my list to call tomorrow morning. I am so excited that I ran into you. It's like it was meant to be." And I thought, thank God for search engine optimization. Because, you know, she found me right away. She saw me. It prompted her to, you know, hire us. And she was a great source of business for us. So I think having a name, you know, people thought it was not serious or too silly. I didn't think so. I mean, if people thought we had a little bit of a attitude or we had a little sense of humor, that didn't bother me. And I just think it did capture that we are a fun group to work with. And it does prompt people to say, "How did you get that name?" Or, "What a crazy, I love that word." Or, "What does that word mean?" It's a conversation starter. And what's better when you have a small business than to have an icebreaker when people like, "How did you get that name? Tell me more. That's so interesting. I've never heard that before."
Well,
And so once you get a conversation, you can get a client.
Exactly. Well, ever since I read The Tipping Point, I've been a huge fan of the whole concept of a maven. And I think I told you this before, but I have a mastermind group that's been meeting for over 3 years, and they call themselves the Magic Mavens.
I love that.
So for me, a maven isn't just a know-it-all, but it's a know-it-all that people actually go to when they need to know something. It's the person who knows the answer. And right now, in this current PR landscape, You need to be a maven.
Right. It's like, I don't know everything, but I know the people to introduce you to who know what you need to know. So if I can't do it, I'm one degree from being able to do it.
Yeah. It's so important. I just love the word maven. I love the whole concept of a maven. And I have worked really hard for the last 20 years to be a maven.
Congrats. I love it.
But so have you. So have you. All right. Is there anything else that you want to chat about?
I mean, I think, you know, we live in this world where your online presence matters so much. And the one thing I would just tell your audience is you don't have to be LeBron James or Taylor Swift or Beyonce or Serena Williams to think of yourself as a brand. You're a brand, I'm a brand, and your audience, they are brands too. And I would just encourage everybody to make sure that when somebody looks you up online, that what they find reflects the brand you want to be. Because, you know, if somebody is going to return your phone call or go meet you for coffee or invite you to be a guest on their podcast, they're going to check you out to see if it's worth returning the phone call, if it's worth grabbing lunch, if it's worth talking to you for a few minutes. And so people say, well, I never Google myself. That's so narcissistic. No, it's not. It's a brand check, because when you Google yourself, when you, you know, see what pops up, it better be the things you want to see pop up. And you need to have a consistent message. And it's got to be, again, we talked about it earlier on, the values and the essence of the brand that you're projecting to the outside world. And you can't stand for everything. You're only going to kind of own one or two pieces of real estate in your customer's mind. So make sure that the story that you're telling is consistent, and that if you want people to refer and recommend you, and you want positive word of mouth, make sure all those things sync up. Because if they don't, if on Facebook, you're one person, on Twitter, you're somebody else, and on LinkedIn, it's a different persona or profile, you're not building trust, and you're diluting your brand. You're confusing people. Mm-hmm. And again, I think if we've learned anything in these last 3.5 years is that your online presence, if you don't exist online, you don't exist. Your online presence really matters. So make sure what you're putting out there is what you want people to know about you.
Yeah. I had a gentleman who said, we were in a networking meeting, and he said, my goal for this month is to have 50 Google reviews. And so I was curious. So I Googled him, and I could not find his Google map pin. I couldn't find him. I tried putting in his name, what he did. I tried putting in his name, where he lived. I did all sorts of things to try to find him, and I could not find him. And finally, I looked up the name of his company, and then I found the company. And I was like, dude, no one is going to remember the name of your company. You need to have your name all over your stuff. Yeah. And I don't know if he got it.
You know? I was going to say, you obviously spent a lot of time trying to follow the breadcrumbs. Yeah. And then you gave him invaluable feedback. Mm-hmm. And if he didn't take that to heart, shame on him. Because it's such a wasted opportunity. You get one chance to make a great first impression. And if you blow it, it's going to take a lot more time and a lot more money to get people to come back and invest the energy to connect those dots.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just like you said, that venture capitalist remembered your first name and remembered mavens, and she found you.
That's all.
So every single iteration of Paige Arnoff Fenn, Mavens and Moguls needs to be Googleable. Is that
you
a word?
It. Googleable. It is now.
Did I just make up a word?
It is now. You own it.
Okay. So since you are in this marketing space, I am sure that you have a current, like, trendy thing right now, a marketing tip, trick, or technique right now that is your favorite.
Oh, wow.
Not an old school one, but one that's new.
Well,
did I stump you?
No, you didn't stump me, but I don't, there's not one silver bullet. I think it kind of depends on your brand, your timing, a lot of stars have to align. I am a little old school, I will admit. I think search engine optimization is critical. Again, if you don't exist online, you don't exist. So make sure you've got all those basics. And you raised it about the guy you were talking about. Google My Business, your online free Google profile. Make sure you check all the boxes. You got to have, the address, the phone number, the hours of operation, a photo, like your LinkedIn profile. I am a huge LinkedIn fan of all the social media platforms. For a professional service firm like mine, LinkedIn absolutely matters the most. Again, you want to have a good summary, you want to have all the photo, all the different, if you're trying to be a thought leader, it's a great platform for publishing articles. You want to make sure you have at least 500 contacts. So again, get the low-hanging fruit right, because if you don't do the basics, doing all the bells and whistles are only going to get you so far. I love newsjacking. And if you don't know what that is, it's taking advantage of a current trend in the market and attaching your brand to it so that, when gas prices were really high last year, remember, it was like getting a gallon during the high inflation period.
Yeah.
Well, Krispy Kreme donuts started tying the price of a dozen donuts to a gallon of gas. Like you would say,
Brilliant.
brilliant, exactly. You would say, what does Krispy Kreme have to do with gasoline?
Yeah.
So find those trends out there. Everybody, all these brands, I worked for P&G and Coca-Cola that had huge marketing budgets so they could sponsor the Super Bowl, the Olympics. But a lot of brands can't afford to do that. But you can do things that are kind of scrappy and resourceful on Twitter, on X, or you leverage your social media platform
Or threads.
Threads, exactly. So I grew up in New Orleans, and years ago the Super Bowl was in the Superdome in New Orleans. I don't know if you remember, the power went out in the middle of the game, and Oreo cookies immediately jumped on it, and they went on, which w it was Twitter back then, it wasn't X, and they said you can still dunk in the dark, and that ended up being like it started to just take off. They were not a Super Bowl sponsor. They didn't have to use the official name and logo, but they were the most memorable brand of that Super Bowl about dunking in the dark. And I just read that they are going to come back and sponsor the next Super Bowl. And, now they're actually, I think, going to try and sponsor, but I bet they don't get as much attention as they did when they weren't
Well,
sponsoring because they were
probably not.
so resourceful.
How do you feel about Wendy's social media? I mean, I don't know if you follow what they're doing, but they're just the person who is managing their social media account makes really weird posts like, ha ha ha, Katie fell off the curb, or things like that. How do you feel about that?
So, I mean, I guess maybe that person knows their target audience better than I do. I think that the really smart kind of quote random social media, I think, is when you'll see Burger King or McDonald's jabbing each other, or Taco Bell and Chick-fil-A, but they're making kind of jokes that are targeted to their exact audience and kind of poking fun at their competitors. I think those are brilliant. I think those are really smart. The ones, I mean, again, the ones like you were referring to, I don't get it at all. So I just assumed maybe that's for people that are just right in their bullseye. Maybe in the crosshairs you get that. I just think it's a waste of effort, waste of energy. But I think, again, if you've done your homework, if you've done your market research, like how to play off your biggest competitors. And when you do that well, it's clever and memorable. And people really get into it. Like your customers kind of get in on the joke, and that's when it's magic.
Well, and if the companies are in on the joke too, that's funny. So in the town that I used to live in, there was a, and you're going to recognize this name, there was a Luby's across the street from a Mexican restaurant. And they had the sign, you know, the signs on the outside of the, you could put the little words up, right? And right. They had a sign war for months. No, I mean, they were jabbing at each other for months. And I know that it improved business for both of those restaurants.
No question. That's really smart, because that's being scrappy and resourceful and clever.
And the people who eat at Luby's aren't going to be the people who eat at the Mexican restaurant. So you know what? Go for it. Have fun. just don't go over the top.
Right. And if you're having fun, consumers get that. They want to be in on the joke too. They want to have fun. Mm-hmm. And so it's a way to stay relevant. It's a way to kind of stay out there with your message. And so I think that's brilliant. I love that.
We're running out of time, but I want to cover one more thing. So you keep talking about thought leaders, and thought leadership is actually, you know, that is, to me, that's where you need to go. And I see influencers just making crap content, right? And calling themselves influencers. So how do you balance, or what is your vision? What is your prediction of what the future of influencer is going to be?
I wish I had a crystal ball, but I think one of the hardest things is Kim Kardashian, Kylie Jenner are in a class by themselves. There are people who are like mega influencers that with a tweet or two, you know, they post a couple of things on Instagram or X and they can move the needle. But mm-hmm. that is absolutely the minority.
Yeah.
And I think for most brands, including my clients, micro influencers and nano influencers are probably a lot more beneficial and useful to your audience, because they have a niche where they are very important, and they have a following that trusts them, that look to them for advice, whether it's a tech person or a food person or a drink person, whatever your niche is. And it's like less is more, because, you know, it's a small audience. It's not in the hundreds of millions.
Yeah.
Or, you know, tens of millions of the big celebrities. But if you have 10, 20 people that are really strong in your niche and you get them to say a few choice prime things about your business, that could really move the needle. I know for my business, I don't need 1,000 customers to have a great year. If I signed 10 new clients a year, it would be awesome if they're the right clients.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of people kind of turn their nose up, or they kind of poo-poo. That's just a niche market. It's just a nano influencer. It's just a micro influencer. That can be incredibly much more valuable to a small business than having Kim Kardashian say something.
Well, I consider myself a micro influencer. I mean, I have a very small, loyal audience. But I've also had some strategic partnerships with some big brands that are under the radar. Like, I'm not doing anything public facing about it. I'm just working with them behind the scenes on projects because they want to hear from me, from my feedback. And it gives me street cred. And the thing is, because I show up authentically and as myself, and I, you know, do what I say I'm going to do, they're sharing my information with other brands.
Exactly.
And so it's being a micro influencer, nano influencer, if you can do it in a way that isn't pukey, you know, don't show your butt, you know, be, you know, I mean, I'm sorry that butts don't sell anymore. They just don't, right? Because everybody shows theirs. So,
no,
you know,
but for you, show it's up. Like, it's authentically you. And when you're in your lane and you're doing your thing, that's a win-win. When you can be you and attached to the brand, everybody wins.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's a win for them. It's a win for me. It's a win for my audience.
Bingo.
Because my audience benefits from these partnerships that I have, even though they don't know about them, because, you know, I'm more of a researcher kind of person. They're asking me questions and getting feedback on stuff, but I get advanced copies of things that I can share with my audience, right? Or I can use tools that will help them. So, you know, that's just, it's so powerful. So I highly recommend that brands use people like me, because we will be your biggest fan.
Without a doubt. And I think back to your thought leadership, that's kind of the, you know, the thing that we aspire to. When you start building that momentum, what's great is you can repurpose all the things that are starting to get traction. You can turn it into an ebook, turn it into a blog post, turn it into a posting on LinkedIn, put a, you know, so it starts feeding on each other. So repurposing the thought leadership and the content that you're generating, you know, partnering with other blogs, partnering with other like-minded brands that have newsletters so that they're talking about it in their newsletter and you're talking about it in your newsletter. All of that kind of grows exponentially.
Do you think that people should put thought leader or micro influencer in their title on LinkedIn?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's more powerful if somebody else calls you that than if you call it yourself. I'm a big fan of show, don't tell. Instead of patting yourself on the back, having other people say, I love working with Candace because she is so critical to this this particular audience. As a micro influencer, as a nano influencer, Candace carries a lot of weight when I need to talk to that audience. If you can get somebody else to use it, 10 times more powerful. But I am not averse to people putting it in their LinkedIn profiles.
And you know, I'm totally taking that clip and putting that on social.
Love it. Love it.
I love it. All right, we need to wrap up. I feel like I want to talk to you for another 7 hours.
I was going to say, we could just keep going, but I love chatting with you, Candace.
So this is your moment of gratitude. Paige Arnoff Fenn, for whom or what are you most grateful?
Without a doubt, my husband. He is my rock, and he's a fellow entrepreneur. And, you know, he's my thinking partner and my butt kicker when I need my butt kicked. And he gets the kind of ups and downs of running your own business and is always there for support. And I know he always has my back.
Thanks for tuning in to Gratitude Geek, the relationship marketing podcast for micropreneurs building genuine, lasting relationships with clients, colleagues, and community. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on Audible, iTunes, Good Pods, or your preferred podcast player. Our theme music is Track 14 by Rev Brock and Solily. Make sure to visit gratitudegeek.com for the show notes, where you can find links to all the resources we've mentioned, including ways to connect with our guest, Paige Arnoff Fenn. I've been your host, Candace Rodarte. Stay groovy, my friends.
Stay groovy, my friends.